This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei blames the United States and Israel for masterminding the recent riots in the country. North Korea's latest ballistic missile launch draws warnings of a tough response from the South, Japan, and the United States. Plus, the upper house of Russia's parliament approves the laws on the integration of four eastern Ukrainian regions. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the recent riots in the country were plotted by the United States, Israel, and their paid agents. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei made the comments in an address to military cadets in Tehran. The leader said he was saddened by the death of the young woman, which triggered the riots, but he said reactions to the incident, including insecurity on the streets and burning of the Holy Quran and mosques, were not normal. Ayatollah Khamenei said the death of the young woman was a pretext for some foreign governments to foment insecurity and rioting. The leader added that such governments cannot tolerate Iran's progress and power. Ayatollah Khamenei described those governments as bullies, saying that they are taking aim at Iran's independence, resistance, and power. The UK-based political analyst Masoud Chajari says the tragic death of Mahsa Amini has been used as a pretext by Iran's adversaries to instigate riots in the country.
It is a very sad affair of loss of the life of a young woman. But this is not the issue. This has been an excuse for rioting, killing people, burning security officers, and burning buildings, etc., etc. And, you know, it's very clear for a very long time opponents of Iran, the regime in occupied Palestine, United States and Saudis and have been saying very clearly that they are set to create disharmony, they are there to actually create havoc within Iran and create this type of thing. And even when we hear the maximum pressure is a catalyst for creating the environment when this sort of thing could take place. This is really trying to create a sort of havoc that was indeed implemented in Libya, in Syria, and elsewhere. This is actually trying to destroy the whole infrastructure and bring such insecurity, which will affect every Iranian, be it their supporter or opponent of any issue whatsoever.
Iran's president says people's million-strong turnout in the protests against the recent riots foiled the enemy's plots during the unrest. Ebrahim Raisi echoed the Monday remarks by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, saying the U.S. and Israel hatched the plot to hinder Iran's advancements. The president added that the enemy is angered by the progress Iran has made despite threats and sanctions. The riots erupted over the death of a young woman in a police station in late September. Days later, Iranians held nationwide rallies to condemn the street violence. Muslims in London have rallied to denounce a recent Islamophobic violence in the British capital amid ongoing anti-Iran riots. Following the death of Iranian woman Mahsa Amini, several Western anti-Iran groups have staged anti-Iran demonstrations in European cities in which Muslims and police have been attacked. Robert Carter reports.
Muslims in London were compelled to mobilize outside an Islamic center on Saturday following recent Islamophobic violence by anti-Iran protesters. On Sunday, the 25th of September, London witnessed an outpouring of anti-Muslim attacks as protesters claiming to support Mahsa Amini were filmed attacking Shia Muslims commemorating Arba'een and the Iranian Islamic Center of England, following clashes with police outside Iran's embassy.
Last week, our mosque was attacked. Our procession was attacked. People were attacked that weren't even Iranian, had nothing, they didn't know anything about what was going on. And it impedes our freedom of religion in this country.
Protests over the death of Amini, a 22-year-old Iranian woman who fell to the floor at a police station on September the 16th, started shortly after her death was announced. Those protests soon turned into violent riots, with masked people attacking security officers, resorting to vandalism and desecrating religious sanctities, including hijab burnings. Dissident groups outside of Iran were quick to board the bandwagon, engaging in violent protests throughout Europe, especially in London and Paris.
We've got people not of an Iranian origin, but in fact of multinational origin who've come out here to direct their anger to these people who are loaded with anti-Islamic people, LGBT people, and all elements which are anti-Islam who've come out here to side with an event which has happened in Iran. But really, they don't care about that event.
A police presence remains outside the Islamic Center, that groups are continuing to target the site.
Saturday's demonstration passed by peacefully without any major incidents occurring. However, locals informed me that they remained deeply concerned that future attacks may take place. They also informed me that they were deeply frustrated that the local authorities who failed to protect the community. Robert Carter, London.
Iran has once again rejected Ukraine's claims that it has provided Russia with combat drones for the war in Ukraine. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani called the allegations baseless and invalid. He said the Islamic Republic's stance on the war in Ukraine is quite clear and has been officially announced before. Commenting on the recent referendums held in four Ukrainian regions which paved the way for their incorporation into Russia, Kanani said Tehran, based on its principled policies, always insists on fully observing other countries' territorial integrity. He added that Iran believes that any provocative action which disrupts the path towards peace and stability should be avoided. The spokesman noted that over the past few months, Iran has stressed the need for warring sides to resolve their problems through political means. Canada has imposed fresh sanctions on 34 Iranian individuals and entities over alleged human rights violations. The sanctions list announced by the Canadian Foreign Minister includes 25 people as well as 9 entities, including the English news network Press TV. The move comes a week after Prime Minister Justin Trudeau pledged to impose sanctions on the Iranian government. This is not the first time that Canada has come up with such measures against Iran, with which it does not have any diplomatic relations. Ottawa in the past has blacklisted around 200 Iranian entities and individuals. Russia takes another step further to finalize the annexation of the four Ukrainian regions into its territories. Now the upper house of Russia's parliament says yes to the move. The Federation Council enacted legislation by unanimous vote to incorporate Donetsk, Luhansk, Kherson, and Zaporizhia to Russia. That after the country's lower house, the State Duma, gave its green light to the annexation on Monday. The ratified documents will be submitted to the Kremlin so that President Vladimir Putin will sign the annexation into law. Putin had earlier signed a decree for the formal incorporation of the four areas. Moscow says people in these four regions have voted overwhelmingly to join the Russian Federation in referendums held last week. But Ukraine and its Western allies have called the votes illegal and a sham. Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, North Korea has test-fired an intermediate-range ballistic missile over Japan amid heightened tensions in the Korean Peninsula. The test triggered an emergency alert in northern Japan on Tuesday morning, where residents were told to take shelter. Tokyo says the missile covered the longest distance ever recorded for a North Korean launch. It was also the first time that a North Korean projectile passed through Japan's airspace since 2017. The missile test has drawn outpouring of reactions. Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida has described it as barbaric. The country's defense minister says Tokyo will consider all options, including what he calls counterattack capabilities against Pyongyang. South Korea has also rebuked the North, warning of a decisive response.
이런 무모한
North Korea's such reckless nuclear provocation will face resolute response from our military as well as our allies and the international community.
The U.S. also says the National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan separately talked with his South Korean and Japanese counterparts about Pyongyang's move. Sullivan has reportedly consulted on a, quote, robust joint and international responses to North Korea's launch. Tensions are running high in the Korean Peninsula. Last week, Pyongyang conducted short-range ballistic missiles on four occasions. It came after South Korea, Japan, and the U.S. held joint anti-submarine drills on Friday. North Korea considers such military maneuvers as rehearsals for an invasion. To discuss that further, we're joined by our correspondent in Seoul, Jennifer Chang, and also Emmanuel Pasrich, a president of the Asian Institute from China. Thank you very much to both of you for joining us. Let's begin with our correspondent, Jennifer. The latest launch was Pyongyang's fifth in 10 days. Why is North Korea intensifying its missile launches at this point in time? Do you see that a prelude to testing a nuclear weapon?
Yes, in fact, experts, they were saying that October 16th to November 7th was the time frame. This came from the South Korean National Intelligence Service, which is the country's spy agency. But with today's test, which was the longest test ever for a North Korean missile, now experts are saying this test could be conducted even sooner, this nuclear test that North Korea watchers have been looking for 4 months now, because North Korea has been detected making repairs at its Punggye-ri nuclear testing site in northeastern North Korea, where it fired another six nuclear missiles. So this is going to be carefully watched, this ballistic missile fired today, which the South Koreans said was an intermediate range ballistic missile, but which the U.S. saw as more of a threat to the U.S. mainland, calling it a long range missile, or ICBM in other words. So right now, all eyes are on North Korea. Even with the war in Ukraine, all eyes are there because North Korea is now expected to conduct either a nuclear test or a submarine-launched ballistic missile test. It has been working on those two fronts. And it is feeling very alarmed because the U.S. and South Korea recently resumed large-scale military drills aimed at stripping the North of its nuclear weapons with a preemptive surgical strike and also assassinating the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and wiping out the whole North Korean leadership. So last month it passed a law declaring itself a nuclear weapons state and closing the door on any further nuclear negotiations with the U.S. And right now tensions are really getting very high. The missile tests that you mentioned took place before and after joint drills between the U.S. and South Korea, the first naval drills in 5 years, which were followed by trilateral naval drills for the first time in 5 years between the U.S., Japan, and South Korea, as well as an overlapping trip to South Korea and Japan by U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris. So these were a show of the North's displeasure, but the difference between the previous four rounds that took place last week that you mentioned, which totaled 7 short-range ballistic missiles all capable of striking South Korea, the difference between those missiles and today's missile is that today's missile overflew Japan. This is rare for North Korea. It is being seen as a major, major escalation in North Korea's weapons tests.
So, Mr. Pasridge, what is significant about this latest launch, in your opinion, and why are Japan and South Korea reacting so strongly this time?
Right. Well, it is a continuum from previous missile launches, as Jennifer Chang had accurately identified, and I think it's best to see this as part of a larger buildup of the military throughout all of Northeast Asia and all of East Asia. So it's not uniquely North Korea. All of these countries have made massive increases in the military spending. The most concerning part, obviously, is the flyover of Japan. I would certainly want to say this is not appropriate, and it was a violation of the airspace of Japan. It's not unique in what's happening in the world, however, and it particularly is dangerous because it was used by the Japanese government as an excuse to restrict the activities of Japanese citizens in violation of the Japanese Constitution. So there's a danger that this threat from North Korea is playing into a very obvious effort to reduce Japan to a military society. And that's really what we're concerned with. That's what we're concerned with in all these countries, is the growth of militarism.
Thank you very much, Mr. Emmanuel Pasridge, President of the Asia Institute from China, and also Jennifer Chang, our correspondent, joining us from Seoul. Thanks to both of you for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of the News Review. And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, you heard the story of Imam Khomeini's arrival in Nofel-le-Chateau, a village around Paris, and we told you how his wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi, would patiently receive guests and answer the questions on Islam and Imam Khomeini's movement. Today we are going to continue the story. We hope you'll enjoy it. Upon his arrival in Paris, Imam Khomeini resided at a three-room flat in Paris. But as the guest number increased, the Imam decided to change his residence. Hence, Nofel-le-Chateau village in the vicinity of Paris was chosen. Although the new house was a large villa, there were too many guests, especially students and journalists, so that a tent was set up in the yard. Some of the students would even stay there at nights. Imam Khomeini would perform midday congregational prayer in the yard and then deliver speech. Thus, the small village of Nofel-le-Chateau soon turned into the center of the news in the world. Haj Ahmad, the Imam's younger son, said on those days, "We were informed that, fortunately, our neighbor was going to leave, so we immediately hired the house. We used to do some of the affairs at the same house in Paris, so anyone who came to visit the Imam could sojourn there for one or two nights. A bus and two minibuses would commute Paris-Nofel-le-Chateau route. The bus driver was a detainee of the Shah regime, and the three minibus drivers were Iranians. One of them was a surgeon, and the other two were students." Dear listeners, unlike Tehran, winter in Paris was very cold, so that often there were icicles hanging from roofs. Therefore, heating was difficult. But the inhabitants would wear warm clothes, and Imam Khomeini would perform congregational prayer in the yard. The affairs of women were administered by a young lady called Ms. Marzieh Dabbagh. She would check any package not to contain a bomb. The affairs of men were also administered by Mr. Mehdi Araghi, who was described by Imam Khomeini as equal to 20 men. Araghi would sleep very little, and he would say, "It is the time of working and endeavor as I have rested in prison." This was while, according to his inmates, he would rest very little even in prison. During the short stay in Paris, Imam Khomeini's wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi, visited a few places in the city like the Eiffel Tower. She'd also paid a visit to some of her relatives who lived in Paris. On January 16, 1979, the Shah and his wife Farah left Iran for Aswan in Egypt. They had already sent their three children to the U.S. Therefore, his escape from the country was the top news of the day. So the news soon reached Paris, and everyone was happy, even some of the foreign journalists in Neuf-le-Château. Everyone was waiting for Imam Khomeini's reaction to the news. Ahmad Agha went to him and told him that everyone was waiting to hear his words on the event. Yet Imam Khomeini said that due to the approach of the time for midday prayer, he had not enough time to answer all questions. However, he sat on a chair behind the bars of the yard and congratulated the Iranian people on the Shah escape in cold blood. Then he stressed that the event was the end of the Shah criminal era. He added that he would soon announce his political statement. His statement had emphasized on a few things: the formation of the provisional government, the ratification of the new constitution, and his return to Iran in the first proper time. Dear listeners, if you remember, we had spoken about the reaction of Imam Khomeini's wife on the news of the Shah escape from the country. She had said that if the Shah had listened to the Imam's advice in 1962 to join the nation and turn his back to the bullying governments, he could have stayed in the country. This clearly showed that the Imam and his family had no personal enmity with the despotic Pahlavi regime and their agents, but they were opposed to their corrupt and criminal way of ruling. Ms. Saghafi said on her stay in Neuf-le-Château village, "My few months' stay in the rural house in Neuf-le-Château was very pleasant and lovely. I was sprightly and enjoyed being with the guests."
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei has spoken for the first time after the recent riots that broke out in Iran. He was very clear about one thing: the violent riots in Iran were planned by the U.S. and the Zionist regime in reference to Israel. The capacity of the Iranian armed forces, the leader was surprised how many had not observed the rioting to have its origins stemming from plots hatched by the U.S. and Israel. Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the statements of Iran's leader and dissect what he has described as one of the main motivations of the U.S. and Israel, which is to prevent a strong and independent Iran, including the country's progress. Our guests joining us for this edition of The Spotlight are Kevin Barrett, editor at Veterans Today, who joins us from Madison. Also joining us is Brent Yonkers, historian and journalist, who joins us from Hasselt in from Belgium.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines. featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, Kevin Barrett, if I may. We're looking at Iran's leader to have made a statement and blaming the U.S. and Israel in terms of the deadly riots, which he said were orchestrated and engineered in advance by both. What is your reading into what Iran's leader has said there?
Well, I think he's telling the truth, and he probably could have said it earlier based on means, motive, opportunity, and I would presume intelligence. Reports, but maybe he was waiting a little bit just to be sure. In any case, it is thunderingly obvious that this kind of activity in Iran and in so many other countries around the world that are trying to be independent sovereign nations rather than vassal states of the U.S. empire are being subverted with these kinds of activities. And I do assume that the leader has access to very detailed and accurate reports about what's been going on. But even without those, just from a big picture analysis, in the same way that we know who blew up the Nord Stream pipeline based on who tried to stop it from being built, who threatened to blow it up if a war in Ukraine should break out, who controls that part of the Baltic, and so on, we know that was the U.S. empire and its NATO military infrastructure. And likewise, based on the historical record in which the United States military and CIA has murdered about 60 million people, well, this was actually before the 9/11 wars, so it's now up to pushing towards 100 million people in interventions since World War II, many of which involve destabilizing countries by fomenting chaos and then moving in. And in the old days, they used to take over the country. Now they just destroy it and turn it into an anarchic wasteland, as they've done to Libya, and they certainly destroyed Syria, although it seems to be bouncing back. So we know from historical patterns that this had to be part of this U.S. destabilization operation process that's been going on for so long. And we know that they orchestrated the attempted color revolution about, 12, 14 years ago, that so-called Green Revolution. And they orchestrate all the color revolutions. So I think the supreme leader, in a sense, is belaboring the obvious. But it's great that he's willing to say this, because it's interesting how, as the U.S. commits these crimes all over the world, how few leaders are willing to stand up and talk about it. Everybody knows the U.S. just blew up the Nord Stream pipeline and that Europe is going to starve and freeze this winter because of the United States and its declaration of war against the European Union. But all of the leaders in Europe are afraid to say that. So it's good that we have at least one leader in the world courageous enough to state these simple and obvious truths.
Well, Brett Yonkers, based on what our guest, Kevin Barrett, said, these are things that should be acknowledged and should be brought into the conversation, and in this case, when Iran is the topic. Now, the color revolutions on the one hand, destabilization activities on the other, that the U.S. is guilty of, it's all out there. We could talk about it, but we need a few programs to talk about it, at a minimum. But what's interesting is what a former CIA official by the name of Bruce Riddell said once. He said, for years, the U.S. has been acting against Iran, and I'm going to quote him, "There's little doubt that there is a covert war underway against Iran. There are at least two players in it, the United States and Israel." So that kind of gives credence to what Iran's leader has said, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. There are numerous ways for us to know, including indeed the admissions of CIA agents or former CIA agents and American agents in general. But also, if we just look at the facts the way they are, all of this campaign and the dozens of people that have been killed in the violence that has ensued following the death of Mahsa Amini in the police custody, and the quote-unquote cause of this instability. When you see all the things that have taken place in such a short time, you'd have to be deluded to believe that this all is a spontaneous response to the death of one woman who we know for a fact was not murdered by police. The CCTV footage is there, the video footage is there. We know she collapsed in the police station. So we know she was not touched by anyone anywhere around the time when she died. So we know that she was not killed by the police. This video footage was definitely not part of the plan of the imperialist plot when they tried to pin this on the quote-unquote morality of the police and say that she was quote-unquote murdered by the police. But what this death in and of itself was just the little spark that they needed. But we can say with absolute certainty that the violence and the instability and the terrorism that has been going on against Iran in the past weeks was pre-planned. There is no way that suddenly the death of one woman, that suddenly is the actual cause that causes Kurdish separatists, terrorists in the north of Iran to start killing people, to start committing terrorist attacks by Balochistan near Zahedan by Baloch separatists and Takfiri terrorists who are active there. International protests, international manifestations trying to foment the ethnic strife in Iran and trying to break Iran apart on ethnic lines. I have seen people talk, calling for the Kurds to tear away from Iran, for the Azeris to tear away from Iran, for the Balochs to tear away from Iran. This is all pre-planned. This is all preordained already months ago. There is no way that this is a organic revolution. And it is not a revolution. It is a plan that is put into motion every so often. And it's only been a couple of years ago that there was a previous round of such fomented attacks against Iran. This happens every couple of years because the plan is, the American plan, is that they want to keep trying to destabilize, and the Zionist plan as well, to destabilize Iran more.
That's
and more.
A good point.
Every year we try something new, hoping that it would work, and every few years they are defeated again by the forces of the Islamic Republic.
So that's a good point that he makes there, Kevin Barrett, if you can add to that, because we're not looking at just, for example, the protests that are happening in Tehran, or in many cities perhaps across the country, but we're looking at different elements that either have used the protests to ignite themselves into pre-planned execution of instability and insecurity and violence, where they're sitting back waiting for a reason to come out. Of course, in northwest Iran, the Kurds, as our guest there from Hasselt mentioned. How do you see the fact that there are different actors, destabilizing actors, waiting for opportunities to create havoc inside the Islamic Republic?
Yes, I think it's obviously centrally coordinated, as he said, and that was a very good summary, by the way. It's interesting that these protests, which are supposedly around this police brutality and hijab issue, which, of course, as it turns out, as we heard, the CCTV footage shows that this was it was not the George Floyd situation where the person was directly killed. So it's now breaking out as ethnic separatism. What does ethnic separatism have to do with this issue? Well, what it has to do with is that the CIA, which of course has been running a covert war on Iran alongside the Israeli Mossad, which has been murdering Iranian scientists, 17,000 Iranian civilians have been killed by these terrorists, mostly these MEK terrorists backed by the West now, after they were taken off the terrorist list a decade ago. And of course, many of those murders happened before that as well. So the central organization of an attempt to break up Iran along the lines of the Oded Yenon plan to balkanize the region in service to Israel is apparently underway. And both the Zionists and the American Empire have a geostrategic interest in pursuing this course. The Zionists have a much stronger one because the Islamic Republic of Iran has been the most principled opponent of Zionism and the strongest supporter of the Palestinians. And of course, that's the biggest reason why the American Empire, which is largely controlled by Zionists, has insisted on going to war, even if covert war, against the Islamic Republic since its very beginning. And the American geostrategic interest here really should be to work with the Islamic Republic. There's no reason why the U.S. needs regime change in Tehran. But the policy is dictated by the Zionists, who need endless U.S. hostility to the region. So they have this coordinated effort to destabilize the country, working with paid ethnic separatist elements and such. And so as soon as there was any excuse, they flipped the switch and set off these riots, which, again, have everything to do with a destabilization attempt and really nothing to do with the ostensible issue.
Well, this is an interesting statement coming from Iran's leader, where Brett Yonkers, he said, and I'm going to quote him, "The enemies do not want such progress to happen in the country," in reference to progress that Iran's leader mentioned happening in all sectors, which would facilitate domestic production, as he said, activation of knowledge-based companies. And he said that they want, the plot was to close universities to stop that progress, to create insecurity on the streets, and to engage in state officials with new issues. For example, as you mentioned, in northwestern and southeastern parts of the country. This is interesting because we're looking perhaps not just the JCPOA revival talks from coming into fruition, or maybe not, but really the shift that's happening. It's a geostrategic tectonic shift of Iran forces joining with Russia, China, moving towards the east, and really having this economic shift happening overall, where Iran's progress would be part of that, given the fact that this 13th administration has been so gung-ho with joining different organizations and trade blocs minus the U.S. or the West. How much validity do you see in that statement coming from Iran's leader?
I think that is an absolutely key issue to understand when you want to ask and when you want to answer the question, why now? Why must this happen now? And the reason for that is that just a couple of weeks ago, we saw what is possibly the most pivotal international geopolitical meeting that we have ever seen in our lifetime, or at least in my lifetime, which is the 22nd summit of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in Samarkand in Uzbekistan. This was almost completely uncovered in Western media. They just didn't talk about it, but you can be absolutely sure that in the actual halls of power in the West, there was a gigantic fear about this happening, because the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is the biggest geopolitical bloc in the world. There is no economic or political power in terms of GDP, in terms of population, that and in terms of military prowess even, that is stronger than the SCO. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization is not a mutual defense pact as such, but it is a pact of close mutual cooperation and in some ways also self-defense. They will cooperate against terrorism, they will cooperate against regime teams, operations across their own sectarian and religious and political lines from a perspective of non-interference and anti-imperialism. And now, of course, the Samarkand summit saw the official admission, or at least the approval of the admission of the Islamic Republic of Iran into this bloc, which means we are talking about a geopolitical unit that counts Russia, China, India, Pakistan, and now Iran, as well as other member states, as its members. This is an incredibly powerful template to use for the future. And it is basically a part of the rise of Eurasia, the rise of the East, and the new Silk Roads, like have been the things that have been talked about in Russia and in Beijing for years, but it's now really coming forward. And when you see that Iran, which is such an important player in this, in the ancient Silk Roads, and then also in the possibility for the new Silk Roads and for the let's say the integration of the political sphere of Eurasia, when Iran joins this, this is a gigantic slap in the face for the American Empire and for the Zionists. And this is most likely the most important reason why they had to grab anything they could grab their hands on, in this case, the tragic death of a woman in police custody.
Sure.
Grab this in order to try to foment strife and try to potentially overthrow the Islamic Republic before the official admission of Iran into the SCO.
Thank you for that. I do have to ask you about this, Kevin Barrett, because it was very interesting how during the course of these riots, there were 9 European nationals that were arrested during these protests, in which the nationalities were from Germany, Poland, Italy, France, the Netherlands, Sweden, to name a few. But what's interesting, aside from that, is the fact that back on May 11th of this year, Iran's intelligence ministry said that it had arrested two European nationals and upon questioning said that they had orchestrated a plot to foment chaos, social disorder, and insecurity across the country. This shows the depth, I'm looking at it, the depth of how the different countries, European countries, are involved here in this case in point, and how widespread of a plan they had, an in-depth plan they had to go ahead with the social disorder that they wanted to create. What is your reading into how far in advance they had planned this?
Oh, I'm sure that there are contingency plans for things like this that are sitting around on the shelf pretty much all the time. And then they're dusted off and set into motion when the circumstances seem right to the perpetrators. And it's interesting, as you said, that these Europeans are involved. I'm sure the reason for that is that the U.S. empire has quite a large degree of control over Europe, although it may not much longer if the Europeans wake up and notice who cut off their jugular vein and their energy supplies this winter. But for now, Europe remains fully American occupied, and the NATO people, the CIA and special forces people can work with Europeans, and those Europeans can become proxies, and then they can go into Iran and try and create this kind of havoc. It's easier for them to do it that way because I believe the Iranian services are more wary of U.S. Americans coming into Iran. I've visited Iran many times and was welcomed warmly by everybody, but I know that it's harder for ordinary Americans to do it. So they're probably working through their European vassals. And I think we also should pay attention to the Supreme Leader's statement about progress, that they don't like progress. And I think he's right. The ideology of progress in the West is that everybody has to become neoliberal and decadent, and religion has to be eliminated.
Sure.
That's their version of progress. But the Supreme Leader's version of progress, which is also the version in Moscow and Beijing, is progress means trade between sovereign, equal nation states based in their own respective countries' traditions, fully sovereign states, not owned by a U.S.-based neoliberal empire. And that, I believe, is true progress, and that is what they are afraid of. So I think the Supreme Leader was absolutely right about that.
Okay. This news came out it came out an hour or so before this broadcast and this program, Brett Yonkers, and that is how Canada has imposed fresh sanctions on Iran for even the news when it came out, the way it was worded, was for alleged human rights violations, which included the death of Mahsa Amini, as the wire read. And what's interesting about this is that it actually came out and also imposed sanctions on Iran's Press TV. I'm not too sure how Press TV, in that case in point, will be included at the top of their list when you have media organizations like the BBC and Iran International who are clearly encouraging people to come and riot, to come out and incite violence, because they show those images next to "Please come out and protest." I mean, they even said, if you're on a wheelchair, don't stay at home, come out and protest. Anyways, my question is, isn't Canada accused of human rights violations itself when it was discovered that hundreds, if not thousands, of Indigenous children were buried in mass graves, unmarked mass graves?
Yes, absolutely. And Canada is a country with an extremely bloody history in and of itself, and we're not indeed... With these residential schools, we're not talking about things that happened in the times of the Wild West or the colonization of the Americas. These are things that happened up until the 1950s and even 1960s. So we're talking about things that happened quite recently when we're talking from an historical perspective. And even if you want to do it more recently, Canada is one of the major suppliers of weaponry to countries such as Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates for use against the people of Yemen. Which is one of the most, or at this point, the most destructive conflict in the world. Canada, of course, plays a huge role through its significant Ukrainian diaspora, which has a significant neo-Nazi direction to it, plays a role also in supporting the Euromaidan neo-Nazi government in Kiev in their conflict against the people of the Donbas. So this is really not a country that has much right to say anything, and they should probably, you know, be quiet and fix their own problems first. But this is news to me too. The fact that they find new sanctions, or they always find fascinating, is how these people figure out new to find even more sanctions than what they already did. I'm pretty sure the Canadian economical cooperation with the Islamic Republic of Iran is already quite negligible. So what they still find in order to sanction more, it's absolutely fascinating. I think they always keep a little bit more in the bag just to be able to do more sanctions later, just so that they have the idea that they're doing something useful.
Kevin Barrett, my final question to you is, don't you think that countries should wake up who are allied with the U.S.? And the only the union that I could think of at this point, composed of the 27-member bloc, is the European Union, for example, of which the U.S. is leading them down an economic path of economic disaster, where it's basically almost leading to divisions within the EU, almost having these countries come back to the U.S. or to reinvest in the U.S., relocate their factories, that one of these days the U.S. would turn against them, because the U.S. has a track record, as both you and our other guests have mentioned, color revolutions, et cetera. Aren't other countries afraid that the U.S. would turn their back against it based on their the history that it has established?
Well, yes, of course. Henry Kissinger famously said that it's dangerous to be an enemy of the U.S., but to be a friend is often fatal. And the Europeans are learning that the hard way right now. We're seeing a massive historical shift here where the U.S. is no longer even pretending to take a win-win kind of approach to its dealings with its European vassals. They have gotten the consent of the Europeans to militarily occupy Europe and essentially totally call the shots and dominate Europe now for many, many decades. But that was all under the pretense that it was a win-win situation. Europe wouldn't have to spend very much money on their militaries. They could let the U.S. worry about military affairs. Well, that period may be over now. So we're coming to a real crisis in this clash of geopolitical paradigms, the U.S. neoliberal empire attempting to crush all opposition and take over in the entire world versus the resistance.
Thank you, Kevin Barrett, editor of Veterans Today from Madison. Brett Jonkers, thank you, historian and journalist from Hasselt, Belgium. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Batahway. It's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program, Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion, we have very special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Nur Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, Shaykh, and welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Okay, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the concept of worship after death. We know that the human beings, as they are alive and they are living in this physical world, the believers, in some parts of their life, they are busy with worshiping Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, with praying Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, whether it is a Christian, a Jew, or a Muslim, okay? But what about after death? Because worshiping and praying is, we can say, a spiritual action. And when you are dead, your spirit is not dead and it is still alive. So what about the other world? And what about, for example, the world of Barzakh or Purgatory? Is it at all this worshiping and praying and the concept of Ibadah continued after your death or not?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As an introduction, I think that because maybe some of our audience, they are not familiar with the Day of Judgment, with the day, actually with the world mediator between this life and the Day of Judgment, we have to explain about this different world in order for our audience to get to some extent familiar with these ideas. You know that after the death, because every and each human being that are going to die one day.
Yes.
And after that, they transfer to the world, which kind of mediator between this life and the Day of Judgment. Still, right. Day of Judgment did not arrive, but we call it the day of, we call it the world of Barzakh, which yes. is kind of mediator between this world and the Day of Judgment. And we are talking about the souls of human being transferring to the, this world mediating between this life and the Day of Judgment. And of course, to some extent, it has, reward for the righteous people and the punishment for the evildoers.
Yes.
After that, we have Day of Judgment, which is greatest day. And when we use the day, the term day, actually, this is referring to, sometimes, metaphorically speaking, it is referring and indicating to the maybe some kind of spheres of life,
yes,
which is after this material life. So we have Yawmul Qiyamah, Yawmul, which is the day of resurrection, Yawmul Hasra, the day of regrets, Yawmul Deen, Yawm al-Akhirah and Alam al-Ghayb and Hidden World, all of them, they are talking about the Day of Judgment. Let me come back to the main question. It was about the worshipping in the,
yes.
mediator, or you may call it purgatory life.
Purgatory or Alam al-Barzakh, yes.
Yes. We do not have any kind of worship in that world because in the Barzakh, or the purgatory life, actually you see and you witness to some extent the result of what you have done in this material life. So there is no time for, worshipping, for example, praying, fasting, and so on and so forth. We do not have such a thing in that day. But still, souls of human beings, they are capable of perfection. Because of that, we send some, the reward of, for example, Surah Fatiha,
yes.
for the dead people.
Yes.
For example, we recite the verses of Noble Quran and we send the reward of that for the dead people.